AM and W248DE broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
News, talk, and sports on both sides of the dial from Wisconsin Rapids and beyond. Locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage.
I'm Steve Kathan. After months of hearings and testimony, it comes down to this for the House panel investigating the insurrection. A vote today on whether to recommend a referral for criminal charges against former President Trump. CBS's Scott McFarland.
The possible charges to be referred would be obstruction of an official proceeding, conspiracy, and over the weekend, one committee member discussed the possibility of a charge of incitement of an insurrection. A criminal referral, though, is not binding on the Justice Department. It's just that, a recommendation.
There's been another
WFHR Wisconsin Rapids 1320 AM and W248DE broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
This is Matt LePay, and you're listening to your home for your Wisconsin Badgers on 97.5 FM and 1320 AM WFHR, locally grown radio.
Eastern time, looks like a packed house per usual, and no Christmas decorations, I've noticed. Missed opportunity there, but what do you think is going to happen today, Brian? Brian Kelly, everybody.
Well, this is the conclusion of everything. So at the very least, they're going to summarize everything they've done so far. They're also going to say, hey, look, last time we left it as we're giving them, you know, we gave Donald Trump an opportunity to come forth and talk to us out loud and see it in public, and we all talk about it. And they gave him ample opportunity, and they're going to say, now we've given you ample opportunity, and that's it. Here you go.
And, yeah, and we basically will say, you think they'll just, like, review everything that they've done in the last 10 hearings and just give a refresh to everybody as
yes,
far as what's been found, what revelations? I mean, because the thing is, like, where they started at the first hearing and where we're ending, the amount of more, like, so many more people came forward. So information that they didn't even have when they started the first hearing because of people who, I think, whether it was their conscience or, you know, for whatever reason along the way decided to testify. And so I think where it started and where it's ended is a lot more information than maybe they even thought they were going to get.
Yeah, well, don't forget how awesome it would be if the Wisconsin connection gets brought up, because Robin Voss was also interviewed within the last week or so, just with his conversation with Donald Trump, seeing how much pressure he was under, because he had to come out and declare, you can't do it, which actually caught him some guff. His own investigative body and his own party. His own party turned on him. That's what happens when you create Frankenstein's monster. They come back out and come back at you if you decide to disagree with them at some point, because he said you can't actually decertify the election. So, but at the same time, he also opened up the Gableman investigation, so congratulations for that. Either way, he was interviewed by this committee, and a couple other people were interviewed, and I'm interested to see if they have any more revelations or if they held anything back last time, saying, you know, I felt like the tone of the last hearing was, okay, we've got a bunch of stuff on you. Do you want to come forward and talk to us? Here's your chance.
Yeah.
And now I think they're going to, if they have anything to reveal, they better do it now.
Because wasn't there also a Dane County judge who was subpoenaed?
I believe so. That sounds right. I can't speak to the veracity of that, though.
Yeah, I feel like that was one of those headlines where I feel like I saw the headline, never read the actual article or really wrapped my head around what the consequence of it was. But I think that there was more, as you just said, Robin Voss was subpoenaed. Obviously, we know that Ron Johnson and the fake electors, but are there other Wisconsin connections in this, whether it was the insurrection itself or the hearings, mm-hmm. and who's been talking and who's been subpoenaed and what information was gathered from them. I don't know if we'll hear it today, but
Anytime you hear the name Jim Troupis, think Ron Johnson, because Jim Troupis was he's the lawyer that wanted to give, he's been in and out of this whole situation in of itself, but he was the lawyer who one advised that they could possibly put forth fake electors, but he was also the lawyer who tried to hand Ron Johnson and or Ron Johnson staff members a manila envelope with all the fake electors from Michigan as well as Wisconsin, and I believe one other, I'm not sure, possibly Pennsylvania, to go to the vice president. And Ron Johnson, that's the infamous Ron Johnson. I was only involved for just a couple seconds. It was just me pressing the thing just for a couple seconds. It's fine. When he basically said, here you go. And the vice president said he didn't want it. So those were the fake electors. So Jim Troupas was the one who was like, here you go. Here's the envelope to give to them. And then they said we didn't want it. And so Ron Johnson thinks that's the end of the story. Well, later on after that, after that incident, after being asked about it and after being questioned about it, Ron Johnson said, you know what would be a great PR move? I'm going to hire Jim Troupas on my campaign and pay him $20,000. And what was he on there on the campaign for? To advise him on a recount. To advise him on whether...
If there were to be one.
If there were to be one, to advise him on what would happen if he didn't like the results of the election, basically.
It's good work if you can get it.
Yeah. $20,000 for like basically less than a month of work, maybe a work month and a half. I mean, it's no Claude Lois and Foxconn. That's an entirely different thing. But my point is wow, you can get a Jim Troupas is a nice Wisconsin connection that we're looking for today, possibly to be brought up. I don't know. There's a whole bunch of people. There's Janelle Branchen could be there. Who knows?
I asked this question of Jane before the break, but would you buy the published 8-chapter? All of the findings and read it once it comes out?
No.
And then
not because, look, I've
mostly because I don't have the time. I need the Axios version of this to like sum up and bullet point the entire thing.
Well, you got to understand, like me, they're about to walk into the chamber, so we're gonna cut away here. But for me, it's not that because I read so much news, I'm used to skimming so much. Like, back in the day, I slogged through the Silmarillion with J.R.R. Tolkien's Silmarillion just to get through it and stuff. I don't think I could do that right now. Because I'm so my brain is so trained to skim through things and read them, let's say, while I'm on the air. And like I'm doing right now as the committee comes in. Once you hear the gavel call to order, we're going to go and let Betty Thompson take over.
Absolutely. And so, yep, we're seeing everyone come in, sit down, and... How many people? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's like 10 people. But yeah, they're all getting settled in, and we're going to cut away to the live broadcast, and we'll be here during any breaks and once it is all over.
You're listening to coverage on civicmedia.us.
The Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol will be in order. Without objection, the chair is authorized to declare the committee in recess at any point. Pursuant to House Deposition Authority Regulation 10, the chair announces the committee's approval to release the deposition material presented during today's meeting, and further, its approval to release deposition material that accompanies release of the Select Committee's final report. Good afternoon. And may God bless the United States of America. To cast a vote in the United States is an act of faith and hope. When we drop that ballot in the ballot box, we expect the people named on the ballot are going to uphold their end of the deal. The winner swears an oath and upholds it. Those who come up short ultimately accept the results and abide by the rule of law. That faith in our system is the foundation of American democracy. If the faith is broken, so is our democracy. Donald Trump broke that faith. He lost the 2020 election and knew it. But he chose to try to stay in office through a multi-part scheme to overturn the results and block the transfer of power. In the end, he summoned a mob to Washington, and knowingly they were armed and angry, pointed them to the Capitol and told them to fight like hell. There's no doubt about this. This afternoon, my colleagues will present our key findings, reminding you of some of the information we presented in earlier hearings and telling you how it fits in our broader conclusions. Those conclusions have helped shape the committee's final report. which we'll adopt today pursuant to House Resolution 503, which establishes the Select Committee nearly a year and a half ago. I expect our final work will be filed with the Clerk of the House and made public later this week. Beyond that release, the Select Committee intends to make public the bulk of its non-sensitive records before the end of the year. These transcripts and documents will allow the American people to see for themselves the body of evidence we've gathered and continue to explore the information that has led us to our conclusions. This committee is nearing the end of its work, but as the country, we remain in strange and uncharted waters. We've never had a president of the United States stir up a violent attempt to block the transfer of power. I believe nearly 2 years later, this is still a time of reflection and reckoning. If we are to survive as a nation of laws and democracy, this can never happen again. How do we stop it? This committee will lay out a number of recommendations in its final report. But beyond any specific details and recommendations we present, there's one factor I believe is most important in preventing another January 6th, accountability. So today, beyond our findings, we will also show that evidence we've gathered points to further action beyond the power of this committee or the Congress to help ensure accountability under law. Accountability that can only be found in the criminal justice system. We have every confidence that the work of this committee will help provide a roadmap to justice, and that the agencies and institutions responsible for ensuring justice under the law will use the information we've provided to aid in their work. And for those of you who have followed this committee's work, I hope we've helped make clear that there's a broader kind of accountability. Accountability to all of you, the American people. The future of our democracy rests in your hands. It's up to the people of this country to decide who deserves the public trust, who will put fidelity to the Constitution and democracy above all else, who will abide by the rule of law, no matter the outcome. I'm grateful to the millions of you who followed this committee's work. I hope we lived up to our commitment to present the facts and let the facts speak for themselves. Let me say in closing, the women and men seated around me on this dais are public servants in the most genuine sense. They put aside politics and partisanship to ensure the success of this committee in providing answers to the American people. I especially want to thank and acknowledge our vice chair, who has become a true partner in this bipartisan effort, Ms. Cheney of Wyoming. And I also recognize her for any opening statement that she cared to offer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your tremendous leadership of this committee. I know we all have benefited greatly from your wisdom and your wise counsel, so thank you very much. In April of 1861, when Abraham Lincoln issued the first call for volunteers for the Union Army, my great-great-grandfather, Samuel Fletcher Cheney, joined the 21st Ohio Volunteer Infantry. He fought through all 4 years of the Civil War, from Chickamauga to Stones River to Atlanta. He marched with his unit in the Grand Review of Troops up Pennsylvania Avenue in May of 1865, past a reviewing stand where President Johnson and General Grant were seated. Silas Canfield, the regimental historian of the 21st Ohio Volunteer Infantry, described the men in the unit this way. He said they had a just appreciation of the value and advantage of free government and the necessity of defending and maintaining it. And they enlisted, prepared to accept all the necessary labors, fatigues, exposures, dangers, and even death for the unity of our nation and the perpetuity of our institutions. I have found myself thinking often, especially since January 6th, of my great-great-grandfather and all those in every generation who have sacrificed so much for the unity of our nation and the perpetuity of our institutions. At the heart of our republic is the guarantee of the peaceful transfer of power. Members of Congress are reminded of this every day as we pass through the Capitol Rotunda. There, 8 magnificent paintings detail the earliest days of our republic. One, painted by John Trumbull, depicts the moment in 1793 when George Washington resigned his commission, handing control of the Continental Army back to Congress. Trumbull called this, quote, one of the highest moral lessons ever given the world. With this noble act, George Washington established the indispensable example of the peaceful transfer of power in our nation. Standing on the west front of the Capitol in 1981, President Ronald Reagan described it this way: the orderly transfer of authority as called for in the Constitution routinely takes place, as it has for almost 2 centuries, and few of us stop to think how unique we really are. In the eyes of many in the world, this every 4-year ceremony that we accept as normal is nothing less than a miracle. Every president in our history has defended this orderly transfer of authority, except one. January 6, 2021 was the first time one American president refused his constitutional duty to transfer power peacefully to the next. In our work over the last 18 months, the Select Committee has recognized our obligation to do everything we can to ensure this never happens again. At the beginning of our investigation, we understood that tens of millions of Americans had been persuaded by President Trump that the 2020 election was stolen by overwhelming fraud. And we also knew this was flatly false. We knew that dozens of state and federal judges had addressed and resolved all manner of allegations about the election. Our legal system functioned as it should, but our president would not accept the outcome. Among the most shameful of this committee's findings was that President Trump sat in the dining room off the Oval Office, watching the violent riot at the Capitol on television. For hours, he would not issue a public statement instructing his supporters to disperse and leave the Capitol, despite urgent pleas from his White House staff and dozens of others to do so. Members of his family, his White House lawyers, virtually all those around him knew that this simple act was critical. For hours, he would not do it. During this time, law enforcement agents were attacked and seriously injured. The Capitol was invaded, the electoral count was halted, and the lives of those in the Capitol were put at risk. In addition to being unlawful, as described in our report, this was an utter moral failure and a clear dereliction of duty. Evidence of this can be seen in the testimony of President Trump's own White House counsel and several other White House witnesses. No man who would behave that way at that moment in time can ever serve in any position of authority in our nation again. He is unfit for any office. The committee recognizes that our work has only begun. It's only the initial step in addressing President Trump's effort to remain in office illegally. Prosecutors are considering the implications of the conduct that we describe in our report, as are citizens all across our nation. In 1761, John Adams wrote, "The very ground of our liberties is the freedom of elections. Faith in our elections and the rule of law is paramount to our republic. Election deniers, those who refuse to accept lawful election results, purposely attack the rule of law and the foundation of our country." The history of our time will show that the bravery of a handful of Americans doing their duty saved us from an even more grave constitutional crisis. Elected officials, election workers, and public servants stood against Donald Trump's corrupt pressure. Many of our committee's witnesses showed selfless patriotism and their words and courage will be remembered. The brave men and women of the Capitol Police, the Metropolitan Police, and all the other law enforcement officers who fought to defend us that day saved lives and our democracy. Finally, I wish to thank my colleagues on this committee. It has been a tremendous honor to serve with all of you. We have accomplished great and important things together, and I hope we have set an example. And I also want to thank all of those who have honorably contributed to the work of our committee and to our report. We have accomplished much over a short period of time. Many of you sacrificed for the good of our nation. You have helped make history, and I hope helped to right the ship. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Gentlelady yields back. As you know, this is our final meeting of our committee. Over the course of the last year and a half, we presented evidence in 10 public hearings, testimony from our brave law enforcement officers, senior White House, and campaign officials, and many others. Today, we are prepared to share our final findings with you. But before we do so, it's important to remember what we've learned, and critically, exactly what happened at the United States Capitol on January 6th. Without objection, I include in the record a video presentation of some of the key evidence our investigation has uncovered.
There were officers on the ground. They were bleeding. They were throwing up. I saw friends with blood all over their faces. I was slipping in people's blood.
As I was swarmed by a violent mob, they ripped off my badge. They grabbed and stripped me of my radio. They seized ammunition that was secured to my body. They began to beat me with their fists and with what felt like hard metal objects.
Fuck you.
Right out of the box on election night, the president claimed that there was major fraud underway. I mean, this happened, as far as I could tell, before there was actually any potential of looking at evidence.
I didn't think what was happening was necessarily honest or professional at that point in time. So yeah. That led to me stepping away.
Generally discussed on that topic was whether the fraud, maladministration, abuse, or irregularities, if aggregated and read most favorably to the campaign, would that be outcome determinative? And I think everyone's assessment in the room, at least amongst the staff, Mark Short, myself, and Greg Jacob, was that it was not sufficient to be outcome determinative.
I told him that I did believe, yes, that once those legal processes were run, if fraud had not been established, that had affected the outcome of the election, then unfortunately, I believe that what had to be done was concede the outcome.
What were the chances of President Trump winning the election?
After that point?
Yes.
None.
So what are we going to do here, folks? I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
The numbers are the numbers, and numbers don't lie. We had many allegations, and we investigated every single one of them.
Did one of them make a comment that they didn't have evidence, but they had a lot of theories?
That was Mr. Giuliani.
And what exactly did he say, and how did that come up?
My recollection, he said, we've got lots of theories, we just don't have the evidence. You're asking me to do something that's never been done in history, the history of the United States, and I'm going to put my state through that without sufficient proof?
It's a tape earlier in the day of Ruby Freeman and Shea Freeman Moss and one other gentleman quite obviously, surreptitiously passing around USB ports as if they're vials of heroin or cocaine.
In one of the videos we just watched, Mr. Giuliani accused you and your mother of passing some sort of USB drive to each other. What was your mom actually handing you on that video?
A ginger mint. Do you know how it feels to have the President of the United States to target you? The President of the United States is supposed to represent every American, not to target one.
I made it clear I did not agree with the had been stolen or was corrupt, and that there was widespread fraud. And I had told him that our reviews had not shown that to be the case.
And I said something to the effect of, sir, we've done dozens of investigations, hundreds of interviews. The major allegations are not supported by the evidence developed.
Well, my first thought was, this is a terrible idea. Jeff Clark cannot be installed as acting Attorney General of the United States.
You ultimately told us that you described this meeting as a, or the, not this meeting, the Georgia letter that was proposed as an effing murder-suicide pact. Do you remember using the term murder-suicide pact?
Yes.
Was it your impression that the Vice President had directly conveyed his position on these issues to the President, not just to the world through a Dear Colleague letter, but directly to President Trump?
Many times.
My view was that the Vice President didn't have the legal authority to do anything except what he did.
And I said, Tim, hold on a second, I want to understand what you're saying. You're saying that you believe the Vice President, acting as President of the Senate, can be the sole decision maker as to, under your theory, who becomes the next president of the United States? And you said yes. And I said, are you out of your effing mind?
The president was, you know, all the attention was on what Mike would do or what Mike wouldn't do.
There's a telephone conversation between the president and the vice president, is that correct?
Yes.
The conversation was pretty heated.
Apologize for being impolite, but do you remember what she said her father called him?
The P word?
Bring out Pence!
Bring it out!
It was clear that it was escalating and escalating quickly. So then when that tweet, the Mike Pence tweet, was sent out, I remember us saying that that was the last thing that needed to be tweeted at that moment. It felt like he was pouring gasoline on the fire by tweeting that.
I gained access to the second floor, and I've got public about 5 feet from me down here below.
Good copy. They are on the second floor, moving in now. You may want to consider getting out and leaving now. Copy.
The members of the VP detail at this time were starting to fear for their own lives. There were calls to say goodbye to family members, so on and so forth.
Approximately 40 feet. That's all there was. 40 feet between the vice president and the mob.
Donald Trump and his allies and supporters are a clear and present danger to American democracy.
We got derogatory information from OSINT suggesting that some very, very violent individuals were organizing to come to D.C.
As Mr. Giuliani and I were walking to his vehicles that evening, he looked at me and said something to the effect of, Cass, are you excited for the 6th? It's going to be a great day. I remember looking at him saying, Rudy, could you explain what's happening on the 6th? He had responded something to the effect of, we're going to the Capitol. It's going to be great. The president's going to be there. He's going to look powerful.
He personally asked for us to come to D.C. that day. And I thought, for everything he's done for us, if this is the only thing he's going to ask of me, I'll do it.
The president, you know, got everybody riled up, told everybody to head on down. So we basically were just following what he said.
Within 15 minutes of leaving the stage,
President Trump knew that the Capitol was besieged and under attack.
So are you aware of any phone call by the President of the United States to the Secretary of Defense that day?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Are you aware of any phone call by the President of the United States to the Attorney General of the United States that day?
No.
Are you aware of any phone call by the President of the United States to the Secretary of Homeland Security that day?
I'm not aware of that, no.
Did you ever hear the Vice President, or excuse me, the President
no.
ask for the National
no.
Guard? Did you ever hear the President ask for law enforcement response?
No.
You got an assault going on the Capitol of the United States of America. And there's nothing. No call. Nothing. Zero.
I remember Pat saying something to the effect of, Mark, we need to do something more. They're literally calling for the Vice President to be effing hung. And Mark had responded something to the effect of, you heard him, Pat. He thinks Mike deserves it. He doesn't think they're doing anything wrong.
You on the staff did not want people to leave the Capitol.
On the staff?
In the White House.
I can't think of anybody, you know, on that day who didn't want people to get out of the Capitol once the, you know, particularly once the violence started. No. I mean,
what about the president?
Yeah.
Well, she said the staff. So I answered.
No, I said in the White House.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I thought you said who else on the staff? I can't reveal communications, but obviously I think, you know,
I said, good, John. Now I'm going to give you the best free legal advice you're ever getting in your life. Get a great effing criminal defense lawyer. You're going to need it.
General Flynn, do you believe in the peaceful transition of...
Another officer unconscious. The terrorist. What's that?
I don't want to say the election's over. I just want to say Congress has certified the results without saying the election's over, okay?
The chair now recognizes the gentlewoman from California, Ms. Lofgren, for an opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Over the last 18 months, the Select Committee has conducted a congressional investigation of enormous scale, seeking to uncover the depth and breadth of ex-President Trump's multi-part plan to reverse the lawful outcome of the 2020 presidential election. We've compiled an immense volume of documents collected from countless individuals, law enforcement agencies, and federal and state authorities. Many of our efforts to get the evidence required litigation in federal court, including the U.S. Supreme Court. We've taken the testimony of hundreds of witnesses. Now, while we couldn't show them all during the hearings, we focused on those who were most central, including our ex-president's White House aides, his senior Department of Justice officials, and senior members of his campaign. Based on this assembled evidence, the Select Committee has reached a series of specific findings. Now, many of these findings pertain to what has been called the big lie, the enormous effort led by ex-President Trump to spread baseless accusations and misinformation in an attempt to falsely convince tens of millions of Americans that the election had been stolen from him. Beginning even before the election, and continuing through January 6th and thereafter, Donald Trump purposely disseminated false allegations of fraud in order to aid his effort to overturn the 2020 election. Ex-President Trump's decision to declare victory falsely on election night wasn't a spontaneous decision. It was premeditated. The committee has evidence that ex-President Trump planned to declare victory and unlawfully to call for the vote counting to stop, and that he told numerous allies about his intent in the weeks before the election. The committee found that Mr. Trump raised hundreds of millions of dollars with false representations made to his online donors. The proceeds from his fundraising, we have learned, have been used in ways that we believe are concerning. In particular, the committee has learned that some of those funds were used to hire lawyers. We've also obtained evidence of efforts to provide or offer employment to witnesses. For example, one lawyer told a witness the witness could, in certain circumstances, tell the committee that she didn't recall facts when she actually did recall them. That lawyer also did not disclose who was paying for the lawyer's representation, despite questions from the client seeking that information. He told her, quote, "We're not telling people where funding is coming from right now." We've learned that a client was offered potential employment that would make her, quote, "financially very comfortable" as the date of her testimony approached by entities that were apparently linked to Donald Trump and his associates. These offers were withdrawn or didn't materialize as reports of the content of her testimony circulated. The witness believed this was an effort to affect her testimony, and we are concerned that these efforts may have been a strategy to prevent the committee from finding the truth. Throughout the post-election period, ex-President Trump was told repeatedly by his campaign advisors, government officials, and others there was no evidence to support his claims of election fraud. Even since our last hearing, the Select Committee has obtained testimony from new witnesses who've come forward to tell us about their conversations with ex-President Trump on this topic. Here is one of his senior advisors, Hope Hicks.
Seeing evidence of fraud on a scale that would have impacted the outcome of the election, and I was becoming increasingly concerned that we were damaging his legacy.
What did the president say in response to what you just described?
He said something along the lines of, you know, nobody will care about my legacy if I lose. So that won't matter. The only thing that matters is winning.
Despite all that, he continued to purposely and maliciously make false claims, sometimes within a day of being told that a particular claim was false and unsupported by the evidence. By the time the Electoral College met to cast its votes on December 14, 2020, a number of President Trump's senior staff, cabinet officials, and members of his family were urging him to facilitate a peaceful transition to the incoming administration. He disregarded their advice, and he continued to claim publicly that the election had been stolen from him. Numerous state and federal courts evaluated and rejected the Trump campaign's claims of voter fraud, including 11 judges appointed by ex-President Trump himself. Many of these courts issued scathing opinions, criticizing the lack of evidence that ex-President Trump and his allies had advanced to support their claims. Numerous individuals associated with these efforts have since acknowledged that they were unable to find sufficient evidence of fraud to affect the election results, including in testimony to this select committee. Still, ex-President Trump repeated those false claims and tried to convince his supporters the election was stolen. This was an attempt to justify overturning the lawful election results. Donald Trump knowingly and corruptly repeated election fraud lies, which incited his supporters to violence on January 6th. He continues to repeat his meritless claim that the election was stolen even today, and continues to erode our most cherished and shared belief in free and fair elections. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Gentlewoman yields back. The chair recognizes the gentleman from California, Mr. Schiff, for an opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Building on his constant repetition of the big lie, President Trump engaged in an unprecedented effort to obstruct the joint session on January 6th, the proceeding where his electoral loss would be certified by Congress. This effort began in part in the states, which hold, count, and ultimately determine the winners of presidential elections. Many state officials were targeted by President Trump and his campaign. The local election workers he accused baselessly of election fraud, the state officials he pressured to stop the count or to find votes that didn't exist, and the state legislative officials he urged to disregard the popular will of the voters and their oath of office in order to name him the winner instead. Here are the Select Committee findings about President Trump's state pressure campaign. President Trump and his enablers repeatedly pressured state officials to take action to overturn the results of the election. The most dramatic example of this campaign of coercion was the president's January 2nd, 2021 call to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, in which the president urged the secretary to find 11,780 votes he needed to change the outcome in that state. During that call, President Trump again repeated conspiracy theories about the election that his own appointees at the Department of Justice had already debunked. Trump also made what Secretary Raffensperger apparently considered a threat, accurately considered a threat, suggesting that Raffensperger and his attorney, that they could be subject to criminal prosecution if they didn't follow through with his demands. Then, in repeated telephone calls and in-person meetings, Donald Trump pressured state elections officials and state legislators to alter official election results. But courageous public servants, including Republicans like Rusty Bowers, held firm and refused to put Donald Trump over their oath to the Constitution. When Donald Trump's pressure campaign did not achieve the results he wanted, he oversaw an effort to obtain and transmit false Electoral College ballots to Congress and the National Archives. The false ballots were created by fake Republican electors on December 14th, at the same time the actual certified electors in those states were meeting to cast their votes for President Biden. By that point in time, election-related litigation was over in all or nearly all of these states, and Trump campaign election lawyers realized that the fake slates were unjustifiable on any grounds and may be unlawful. In spite of these concerns and the concerns of individuals in the White House counsel's office, President Trump and others proceeded with this plan. The Select Committee has developed evidence that these intentionally false documents were transmitted to multiple officers of the federal government and were intended to interfere with the proper conduct of the joint session, where the existence of so-called competing slates of electors would serve as a pretext for legitimate electoral votes to be rejected. President Trump repeatedly attacked state and local officials who refused to do his bidding, as well as local elections workers who he baselessly accused of fraud. As Ruby Freeman and the testimony of other elections officials so powerfully demonstrated, the people who drew President Trump's ire or were the subject of his lies faced real-world consequences, including public harassment and death threats. Some of these elections workers and officials have been forced to leave their homes. Others have been forced to leave the jobs they loved. Take a listen to Ms. Freeman's story.
Now I won't even introduce myself by my name anymore. I get nervous when I bump into someone I know in the grocery store who says my name. I'm worried about who's listening. I get nervous when I have to give my name for food orders. I'm always concerned of who's around me. I've lost my name and I've lost my reputation.
The treatment of Ms. Freeman and her daughter, Shay Moss, and so many others around the country was callous, inhuman, inexcusable, and dangerous. And those responsible should be held accountable. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Gentleman yields back. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Illinois, Mr. Kingsinger, for an opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Certainly one of the many important components of our federal government is the Department of Justice. It's the body that it's responsible for enforcing our laws and investigating criminal wrongdoing. For this reason, it's of the utmost importance that our Department of Justice operates as a fair and neutral body that enforces our federal laws without fear or without favor. It is this critical function that President Trump sought to corrupt, as he sought to use the Department of Justice to investigate and prosecute purported election fraud and to help him convince the public that the election was stolen. The Select Committee has made the following findings with respect to the Department of Justice. In the weeks immediately following the 2020 election, Attorney General Bill Barr advised President Trump that the Department of Justice had not seen any evidence to support Trump's theory that the election was stolen by fraud. No evidence. Over the course of the three meetings in this post-election period, Attorney General Barr assured President Trump that the Justice Department was properly investigating claims of election fraud. He debunked numerous election fraud claims, many of which the president would then go on to repeat publicly. And he made clear that President Trump was doing, quote, a great, great disservice to the country by pursuing them. After Attorney General Barr's resignation, President Trump requested that the acting leadership of the department, Jeffrey Rosen and Richard Donahue, quote, just say the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressmen. In other words, just tell a small lie to put the facade of legitimacy on this lie, and the Republican congressmen and I can distort and destroy and create doubt all ourselves. Between December 23rd and January 3rd, President Trump called or met with them nearly every day and was told repeatedly the department investigation showed no factual support for Trump's fraud allegations. Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donahue told him that the fraud claims were simply untrue. As Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donahue continued to resist, President Trump then tried to install a loyalist named Jeffrey Clark to lead the department as acting attorney general. On several occasions, Clark met with the president, apparently along with Representative Scott Perry, without authorization, promising to take the actions that Barr, Rosen, and Donahue had refused to take. In particular, Mr. Clark intended to send a letter that he had drafted with the help of a political appointee that the White House installed at DOJ with just weeks left in the administration. Mr. Clark intended to send the letter to officials in numerous states, informing them falsely, of course, that the department had identified significant concerns about the election results in their state and encouraging their state legislatures to come into special session to consider appointing Trump rather than Biden electors. Here's Acting Deputy Attorney General Donahue describing his reaction to Mr. Clark's proposed letter.
Some drafting letters without the knowledge of what the department had actually done in terms of investigations, that he was being reckless. And I recall toward the end saying, what you're proposing is nothing less than the United States Justice Department meddling in the outcome of a presidential election.
Knowing that existing department leadership would not support his false election claims, President Trump offered Mr. Clark the job of acting attorney general. In a dramatic January 3rd meeting in the Oval Office, Rosen, Donahue, White House counsel Pat Cipollone, and White House lawyer Eric Hirschman strongly objected to the appointment of Jeffrey Clark as acting attorney general. Mr. Clark pleaded his case and offered to send the letter that he had drafted. The White House counsel called the Clark letter, quote, a murder-suicide pact. Numerous White House and Department of Justice lawyers all threatened to resign if Mr. Clark was appointed. Donald Trump would be leading a graveyard. It was only after the threat of mass resignations that President Trump rescinded his offer to Mr. Clark. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Gentleman yields back. The chair recognizes the gentleman from California, Mr. Aguilar, for an opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Former President Trump's multi-part plan didn't stop with the states or with the Department of Justice. It touched nearly every component of our federal system, ranging from the courts to Congress to his own Vice President, Mike Pence. In the weeks before January 6th, Mr. Trump turned to the man who had served him loyally for 4 years. He embraced an illegal scheme proposed by John Eastman and others who concocted an unfounded legal theory that the vice president could reject Joe Biden's electoral votes during the joint session. When Vice President Pence and many others, including Trump's own lawyer, John Eastman, told him correctly that former President Trump spearheaded an unprecedented campaign to coerce him to do it anyway, ultimately culminating in a dangerous threat to Mr. Pence's life on January 6th. These are the Select Committee's findings with respect to the pressure campaign against the Vice President. John Eastman admitted in advance of the 2020 election that Mike Pence could not lawfully refuse to count official electoral votes. But he nevertheless devised a meritless proposal that deployed a combination of bogus election fraud claims and the fake electoral ballots to say that Mike Pence, presiding over the joint session, could reject legitimate electoral votes for President-elect Biden. But still, President Trump accepted and repeated Eastman's theory and used it to pressure the vice president to take unlawful action. In multiple heated conversations, President Trump directly pressured Vice President Pence to adopt the Eastman theory and either reject the electors or send them back to the state legislatures. The vice president consistently resisted and repeatedly told the president that he did not possess the authority to do what President Trump directed. This culminated in an angry phone call on the morning of January 6th between President Trump and Vice President Pence, during which the former president repeatedly berated Mr. Pence by cursing and leveling threats. White House staffer Nick Luna was one of the many witnesses.
Did you hear any part of the phone call, even if just the end that the president was speaking from?
I did, yes.
All right, and what did you hear?
So as I was dropping off the note, I remember hearing the word wimp. Either he called him a wimp. I don't remember if he said, you are a wimp, you'll be a wimp. Wimp is the word I remember. Something to the effect, this is, the wording's wrong. I made the wrong decision 4 or 5 years ago.
He seemed to be having issues with his microphone. It's coming in and out. His microphone is coming in and out.
President Trump deliberately chose to issue a tweet attacking Mr. Pence, knowing that the crowd had already grown violent.
Seem to be having issues with the feed here. Let's see if we can switch something else over here for you.
And between 2:30 and 2:35 p.m., the Metropolitan Police line on the west front of the Capitol broke. This was the first time in MPD history that a line like this had broken. Rioters at the Capitol were heard chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," through the afternoon. As a result of this unrest, Vice President Pence was forced to flee to a secure location where he actively coordinated with law enforcement and other governmental officials to address the ongoing violence. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Gentleman yields back. The chair recognizes the gentlewoman from Florida, Ms. Murphy, for an opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ultimately, President Trump did not succeed in bending state and federal officials to his will. At every turn, state officials, the Department of Justice, Mike Pence, and many others stood up for the rule of law and resisted the president's wishes. In that way, our American institutions held after the 2020 election. But that did not stop President Trump. Instead, he turned to his supporters, those who believed his lies about a stolen election. He summoned a crowd to the nation's capital on January 6, hoping that they would pressure Congress to do what he could not do on his own. The Select Committee has made the following findings on this issue. 2 years ago today, in the early morning hours of December 19th, Donald Trump sent a tweet urging his supporters to travel to Washington for a protest on January 6th. "Be there, we'll be wild," he tweeted. Between December 19th and January 6th, the president repeatedly encouraged his supporters to come to Washington. The president's December 19th tweet galvanized domestic violent extremists, including members of the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, and organized militia groups. These individuals began organizing to come to the Capitol in large numbers with the specific intent to use violence to disrupt the certification of the election during the joint session. Prior to January 6th, the FBI, Secret Service, U.S. Capitol Police, D.C. government, and other law enforcement agencies gathered substantial evidence suggesting the risk of violence at the Capitol during the joint session. These included warnings like the following. Their plan is to literally kill people. Please, please take this tip seriously and investigate further. President Trump supporters have proposed a movement to occupy Capitol Hill. Alert regarding the VP being a dead man walking if he doesn't do the right thing. I saw several other alerts saying they will storm the Capitol if he doesn't do the right thing. In the days leading up to January 6th, President Trump's advisors explicitly told him that he should encourage his supporters to be peaceful that day, but he refused. One witness, Hope Hicks, provided the committee with records of her text messages on January 6th. In one exchange with another staffer, he texted her, "Hey, I know you're seeing this, but he," referring to President Trump, "really should tweet something about being nonviolent." "I'm not there," Hicks replied. "I suggested it several times Monday and Tuesday, and he refused." When Ms. Hicks came in to provide testimony to the committee, we asked her about this exchange. Her explanation is that the "he" in this text wasn't the president, but rather it was Eric Hirschman. Take a listen to her testimony.
"When you wrote, 'I suggested it several times,' and it presumably means that the president say something about being nonviolent. You wrote, 'I suggested it several times Monday and Tuesday, and he refused.' Tell us what happened."
Sure. I didn't speak to the president about this directly, but I communicated to people like Eric Hirschman that it was my view that it was important that the president put out some kind of message in advance of the event.
"And what was Mr. Hirschman's response?"
Mr. Hirschman said that he had made the same, you know, recommendation directly to the president, and that he had refused.
Just so I understand, Mr. Hirschman said that he had already recommended to the president that the president convey a message that people should be peaceful on January 6th, and the president had refused to do that?
Yes.
The public will be able to review this in the transcripts and see the perspective Eric Hirschman gave before we took Hope Hicks's testimony. Despite having knowledge of the threats of violence presented by the crowd gathered on January 6th, President Trump gave an incendiary speech, declaring without basis that the election had been stolen and encouraging his supporters to fight like hell. And during the speech and immediately thereafter, President Trump stated his intention to travel to the Capitol with his supporters in an effort to influence the joint session. The Select Committee has developed evidence indicating that President Trump did, in fact, intend to go to the Capitol on the afternoon of January 6th, and that he repeatedly expressed that intention during the afternoon and in the days prior. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Gentlewoman yields back. The chair recognizes the gentlewoman from Virginia, Mrs. Luria for an opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All of President Trump's efforts came to a head on the afternoon of January 6th. Standing on the stage of the Ellipse, President Trump told tens of thousands of angry supporters that the election was stolen, that they had the power to change that if they marched to the Capitol, and that they wouldn't have a country anymore if the president...
You are listening to-